cost us a lot of revenue.
Called the Senate Finance and Revenue Committee to order. Welcome, everyone. We have on our agenda today two bills, so we will open up a public hearing on, do you want to?
I think that's doing both.
Just doing both. Senate Bill 77 and Senate Bill 78. Dr. Warner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The two bills, Senate bills before you, 77 and 78, are the product of the Governor's Task Force on Federal Foreign Payments and County Services. And the Senate Bill 77 established a process where either the county government or the governor can declare a state of fiscal distress that compromises the ability of the county to provide a minimal level of public safety services. And then it outlines a process which includes the establishment of a fiscal control board and lays out how that process would work toward developing recommendations for restoring that minimal level of public services. Senate Bill 78 also grew out of the work of the task force in the interim, and what it does is there's some blanks in it, but what it does is establish a framework for a new county services planning council, and it lays out how that planning council is to be established. So first of all, we have to go through an overview and a background of what the task force did. We have Tim Nesbitt from the governor's office, Mike MacArthur from AOC, and Amber Hollister, also from the governor's office, to go through some background on the task force work.
Welcome all. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Tim Nesbitt. I'm the Deputy Chief of Staff for the governor, and I served as the chair of the task force he appointed in October of 2007, which we call the Task Force on Federal Forest Payments and County Services. Also with me is Bobby Green, who was formerly the Lane County Commissioner and co-chair of our task force, and I'm going to turn my seat over to him for a moment when I finish my overview. Our task force worked for a year to address the fiscal problems that will result from the loss of federal forest payments affecting 33 of Oregon's 36 counties. For 11 months of that year, we were on the edge of a cliff where it appeared that we would not get a reauthorization or a continuation of those payments, and counties would face the immediate loss of about $210 million a year in revenue for federal forest lands. In the last month, however, there was a welcome, although unexpected, reauthorization of those payments on a sliding scale basis for four more years, the first of which is this year. We're already well into this year, this fiscal year. And as a result, we backed up and did some rewrites of our recommendations. We took a longer-term view in terms of what state assistance we might seeking, especially given the challenges we now face in the current recession and how it affects the state's ability to be able to expand its support for these shared services. We also looked at some modest but we think important next steps that should be taken now to begin to plan for and prepare for the loss of these payments, which are now on a declining basis. And I'll show you that in the third slide. But again, here's the amount of money that eventually will be lost in when these payments cease. There will still be residual harvest revenues in the federal forest counties, but they'll amount to less than 10% of the revenues we're now getting in the form of these secure rural schools or federal forest payments. And so the dollar amounts you see on this slide show you what the net loss would be after accounting for the continuation of those harvest receipts. So it's substantial, and it's $33 million a year for schools and $210 million a year for the counties. You see in this table what the dark blue bars represent the reauthorization of those payments, but it's on a sliding scale basis, as you can see. There's a reduction in the first year, the current fiscal year, we're getting 90% of what we got in 06-07. Next year, we'll get 81%, the counties will. In 2010-11, it's down to 73%, and in 2011-12, it's somewhere below 50%. It's a very complicated formula that involves distributions and redistributions with other states. It will be less than half. And then in 2012-2013, those payments cease, and so we're back to the impacts I showed you in the previous slide. What impresses us about this is if we think we can go for another biennium without paying attention to this problem, by the spring of 2011, before the next biennium is done, counties will again be looking at this kind of a situation where they're going to have to live with less than half of the monies they're now getting in the federal forest payments and adjusting their budgets and dealing with the crisis at that time. As to the magnitude of this revenue loss, $210 million, given some of the numbers you've been hearing lately about the state's revenue picture, it may not seem a lot, but it really, proportionately for the most affected counties, exceeds the impact of what the state went through in 2001 through 2003. The left-hand bars show you what the state's experience was, whether measured as a loss of revenue from what had been expected or an actual loss of revenue from the prior biennium, and then where you ended up in 2001-03, somewhere between 20% and just under 10% was the scope of the problems you dealt with then. For our hard-hit counties over on the right-hand side there, general fund and road funds, we see losses exceeding, I think, an average of 24% on the general fund and 40-some-odd percent on road funds. So the magnitude of the impact there is even much greater than that which the state experienced in 2001-03. We identified 20 in our report. And by the way, our report is at the printer, and it will be distributed to all of you next week when we get the printed copies. So what you have there are excerpts we copied, the executive summary and a summary of recommendations, and others with me today will provide other excerpts as well. But you'll get the bound copies distributed next week. In our report, we identified 24 counties that will lose 20% or more of their general fund or road fund budgets. And we also took that measure a step further. Instead of just looking at percent of budgets affected or percent of revenue loss, which doesn't always tell a complete story since some counties have reserves, other counties have already cut to bare bones levels, we really, with the help of the Yamhill County Administrator John Krosick, did what turned out to be a very useful exercise, basically trying to answer the question of how much does it cost to run a county. And Mr. Krosick concluded, having studied the budgets of all 36 counties, that it varies according to the size of the county, and that the less populous counties have higher per capita costs, and those who have more population have lower per capita costs, but somewhere between $155 and $297 per capita is the range that he came up with. And we use that then to measure the impact on counties in terms of, even if they have reserves, how long they could go drawing down those reserves before they went below these lines, which really is a bare-bones county budget. We don't have a library system, and you have minimal sheriff's coverage, and it's a bare-bones level. It's not anything more than that. And that's what we use as our benchmark to identify the most affected counties. And applying those criteria, in particular that benchmark, we found the following counties highlighted among the 24 hard-hit counties as most seriously affected. Those in red there, Columbia County, Curry County, Josephine Lane, Polk. In western Oregon and on the eastern side, Grant and Klamath, they all are counties. Grant should have been in red there. They're all counties whose general fund budgets will be affected by a loss of revenue greater than 20%. And the counties underlined in blue are those who, in 2 to 4 years after the loss of these payments, would be in a similar situation. So they're all counties whose level of revenue support would fall below that benchmark, either in the first or second year after the payments cease, or in the third or fourth year thereafter once they draw down the reserves. I think I may have just misspoken earlier, so I just wanted to make that clear, that those who are highlighted and underlined are the ones who would be first over the cliff, so to speak. Those who are who are noted in blue there would be 3 or 4 years behind them. But again, we don't see a sufficiency of revenue to maintain bare-bones services in those counties.
And Tim, did you at all compare the tax rates? Some of those have very low tax rates that were set in stone with the passage of Measure 50.
Madam Chair, and we'll get to that in a moment. And our report has a complete listing and documentation of that.
Thank
you. This is how it looks on the map. Those in dark red are those who'd be most seriously affected and most immediately affected. Those in the lighter color are still in the hard-hit counties. Those in the green coloration will probably not be as seriously affected. Their budgets will be affected, but not to the point where we think they'll be in an unsustainable situation.
What about the white ones?
They don't get. There are three counties which do not get federal forest payments at all.
Okay.
And those are shown Clatsop, Sherman, and Gillum.
Okay, thanks.
So the way we looked at addressing these daunting problems is to start first with what we think counties and county taxpayers can do to help themselves. And I'll go through in a few slides what we concluded. Then what the state and state taxpayers can do to help the counties, because here we're dealing with an array of services which are really shared, many of them, between the state and the counties, whether it's public health or assessment taxation. There's a nexus in a variety of services where it's really a shared service, shared funding and shared service delivery. Next, we looked at what the federal government can be expected to do, and finally, what better management of federal forests could accomplish longer term. In the first category, what your committee is probably already familiar with, we do have low property tax rates in many of these federal forest counties. They've been locked in by Measure 50. They were counties which, when they had the revenues coming from federal forests as harvest receipts, and then later in the 90s as when the first of the safety net payments were authorized, managed to get by with fairly low property tax rates because they had that other source of revenue. Those rates are now locked in by Measure 50. And in addition, that changed, you know, the whole way in which properties are, the assessed value of properties are treated as opposed to market value, and the changed property ratio really does discount the value of new construction and limit what they can do when it comes to economic development. It limits the revenue dividends they get from future economic development. One example in our report is that a $300,000 home in Coos County coming onto the tax rolls there will generate only $199 per year in county taxes. And we have other examples in our report as well. We concluded, however, that when you look at the combination of Measure 5 and Measure 50 effects, which we call the sidelines on this property tax playing field that the counties have to work with, we still find, on paper at least, a lot of unused tax capacity at the local level. Adding up what counties collect and what jurisdictions within the counties collect, less than half of their tax capacity is being used. That can be misleading in some counties where if you tried to enact a countywide property tax rate increase, you might find that in some areas where there are cities, you're in compression, and so you can't collect it all. But on paper, there's there's less than half of the tax capacity being used at the local level right now. So the way to address that could be the local option taxes or special taxing districts. The latter have the advantage, unlike local option taxes which are temporary, and therefore the rates are temporary, special taxing district is permanent and the rates are permanent. And some examples in our report are the law enforcement levy in Deschutes County, and we've had some approved by voters just in the last year in Clackamas County. There was a library district and a agricultural extension district approved by the voters, and in Douglas County there was an agricultural extension service special taxing district approved as well last year.
And those don't have to be renewed? They can be permanent?
That's right.
Okay.
We end up concluding that counties, and this was a unanimous recommendation of our task force, including all of the members of the legislature who served on the task force, and their names are in our handout, that counties should take advantage of their ability to enact local option taxes and establish new county service districts with the approval of their voters over the next four fiscal years as we're dealing with the phase out of these federal forest payments. How much is reasonable to expect? We looked at the average of all the local option tax levies that have been successful, that have been approved by local voters, and the average impact of these special taxing districts. And we concluded that somewhere in the range of a 10 to 30% increase in county tax rates, which when you look at the effect of such an increase on the combined property tax bill for local taxpayers would range only from 2 to 5%, would be a reasonable expectation. And so we call that out in our report. We think it's unreasonable to think that just because you may be at half of your tax capacity that you could easily double your taxes. First of all, it's not likely voters would approve that. Secondly, it's not easy for a local economy, a local economy to absorb a tax increase like that all at once. So we did look at, finally come to the conclusion that it would be reasonable for counties to look at increasing their tax effort by magnitudes of 10 to 20 or 30% of where it is now. Next, and so this graphically shows you how much of the problem would that solve. Somewhere between 8% and 24% of the shortfall for the hard-hit counties. We ended up using the 24 counties we call the hard-hit counties, who collect about 90% of the federal forest payments as the benchmark to look at the cost of helping, whether it would be county taxpayers or state taxpayers, and the amount of the problem that help would represent. So in this first instance, looking at increases of 10, 20, or 30% in county tax effort, we would see 8, 16, or 24% of the problem solved in terms of the revenue problem. Next, we looked at how the state taxpayers can help the counties. We ended up with 12 recommendations for technical assistance and improved coordination that really don't involve any direct cost to the state. We ended up with 16 recommendations for increased state support, a range of services from state police forensic services to a redistribution of assessment of funds that now support assessment and taxation, support for district attorneys, support for public health, especially focused on low population counties, and better ways to divide monies for local roads, one of which is already coming forward in the governor's transportation package. And we also looked at a separate set of recommendations to help counties with economic development strategies, as well as a few at the end dealing with some of the taxes that you control, property taxes, either protecting counties from the enactment of further tax expenditures that would reduce their tax collections at the local level, or in some cases looking at some of the tax expenditures already on the books, those related to federal lands, the non-taxation of summer homes and recreation facilities on federal lands, for instance, came up in this category. And we added that as a recommendation as well as an increase in the document recording fee for assessment and taxation. So all told, comparing, and we have both biennial and annual costs in our report to help guide your decisions on this, but we end up concluding that maybe as much as 18% of the problem could be solved with increased state support. Most of it in that category of increased state funding for the shared services that are now provided at the county level. So again, we're showing there are ways to help, but we're not coming close to solving all the problems so far, looking at what we could expect at the county level and at the state level. So we next looked at better ways to distribute or redistribute the revenues from these federal forest lands, separate from the idea of these safety net payments, which we're now receiving, which are now phasing out. One big one was the second bullet there. The legislation that, known as the O&C Act, passed in 1937, which provides for the distribution of harvest receipts from O&C lands, mostly in Western Oregon, but also in Klamath County, calls for the counties getting a 75% share. But ever since 1957, counties have been limited to a 50% share by action of the Congress in annual appropriations bills. Congressman DeFazio raised last year the possibility of overriding the rider that usually attaches to the Interior Department's budget every year and saying, let's just go back to the baseline, which is supposed to be 75%. That would have a significant benefit if we can successfully do that in the future. Also increasing the payments in lieu of taxes, which apply to federal lands throughout Oregon, throughout the country. We did get a nice boost in those payments as well in the economic, in the first of the economic stimulus packages, which passed last October, to which the reauthorization of the forest payments was attached. But that continues for only 4 years, so that's another issue we need to continue to work on. And then finally, there'll be a bill heard, Senate Bill 55, in the Judiciary Committee next Monday, which addresses the fourth proposal here, and that is currently it's possible for the state to intercept tax refunds for persons who owe child support. So SB 93, sorry, is the bill that we heard on Monday. If we could also get approval at the federal level, authorization at the federal level for states to intercept tax refunds for persons who owe unpaid court fines and fees and assessments, we could significantly boost our support for our court system and for the other services which are supported by the criminal fines and assessment account.
This bill, is this a congressional bill?
This we have a bill that would create the mechanisms for us to do this if allowed by the feds.
Okay.
Separately, there is a bill, and I understand today that Senator Wyden agreed to co-sponsor it, which is going forward in this Congress, that will allow, that will enable states to do that. So it takes action both at the state level and at the federal level. It should generate over $50 million in a biennium.
And, Tim, just to clarify, would that be from fines from people in those counties or statewide?
Statewide, and there's an existing formula for how we distribute these fines and fees so that fixed amounts would come back to the counties, certain amounts would come back to the general fund of the state. And to the counties, cities, and others. So
it'd go to just the counties in some kind of formula. It wouldn't be the county where the fine was from that it would go back to.
I'm not sure if the formula reflects the county share.
It actually is to the county where the fine was levied. That's
okay. So Joe O'Leary, our public safety advisor, advises me that it would be according to the counties where the fine was collected and owed.
That would make more sense, I think.
Of the $50 million, some odd, we think about $7 million would flow back to the counties in a biennium. This is what we came up with under the category of what the federal government can do to better share its revenues. And you see, again, we're taking slices out of the pie there, out of the problem. But we're not still coming close to making up all the shortfall. And then finally, there's the whole question of the revenue potential from higher harvest levels from these federal forest lands. You can see in the left-hand bar on this chart what counties used to receive in their share of receipts when harvest levels were at the levels they were in the late 80s. You can see how far they drop to less than 10% of those levels when all they have to rely on are harvest receipts as opposed to the federal forest payments. The federal forest payments are based on that left-hand bar, and that's what's declining. We do see scenarios where under the Western Oregon plan revisions recently promulgated by the Bureau of Land Management, we could see perhaps a doubling or more of the harvest levels. That could be done on a sustainable basis. The challenge there is to make sure we're also complying with the protection of endangered species and meeting other environmental conditions and criteria as well. All told, we could see from increased harvest levels and increased sharing of the revenues from those harvests, as we talked about earlier from the ONC lands, solving anywhere from 16% to more than half of the problem. But these will require some time. The Western Oregon Plan revision is now being challenged in court. And the governor as well has filed an administrative appeal on one aspect of it. Even the timber sector has filed an appeal as well. I think it's the Forest Resources Council has filed an appeal. So these things are going to take time. But the governor has mentioned that he thinks a higher harvest level from ONC lands is feasible. He supports something in the range of 500 million board feet a year. That would be something, if I can go back to the earlier chart. That would be something in this range on the right-hand side, which would probably more than double the current level of harvest receipts we have now. Now, that's for ONC lands. That's not for federal forest lands. And if we were to extend the same to federal forest lands, U.S. Forest Service lands, as well as ONC lands, we would probably see an even greater amount of revenue flowing to the counties in line with the amounts we show in this estimate. The primary conclusions we want to bring to you with our report is that there's really no one source for the solutions needed to avert major fiscal crises for the 24 hard-hit counties. Responses will have to come from every level, county, state, and federal. And we think in order to do this right, we really should begin a state county planning process within the next 2 years. A lot of the recommendations in our report for increased state support are not prioritized. And if we talk with different counties, we might hear a different sense of priority about where they could most use increased state support, which is why I think a planning process of the kind we're recommending makes the most sense. There is an urgency, even though we are no longer looking over the edge of this cliff. We'll be looking over a cliff 2 years from now. We'll be right on the edge of going over it 3 years from now. And we don't want to be in a position, again, of not having the ropes and the planks and the tools we need to kind of construct something that gets us to a sustainable level of funding for these critical services. That brings me to what are kind of the bookends of our recommendations. We have 53 recommendations in our report, and they almost all fit in the categories I've described. But the first one begins with a proposal to create a state-county services planning council and engage the counties, the executive branch, and the legislative branch, county by county, at least for those who feel compelled to kind of join in the effort, and certainly I think the hard-hit counties would all be among them, to find ways to identify state support, identify county solutions, and look for ways we can work together to get to a point we're preparing for and planning for and coming up with ways to sustain services with the loss, with the reduction and eventual loss of federal forest payments. The last recommendation in our report deals with the need for addressing counties in fiscal distress. We do not, in our state, have provisions which other states have for dealing with financial control boards or other mechanisms to deal with a situation when a county basically says, we can't afford to be a county anymore. We can't meet that minimum level of, we don't have the funding we need to meet that minimum level of service. It is not just the county's problem, it's the state's problem as well, because we're talking about public safety and public health and services as of the kind of, whether it's assessment and taxation or elections, we just need to be doing those things at the county level. And we can't run a state without them. So those are the recommendations we bring to you today in Senate Bill 78 and 77. And unless you have questions about the entirety of the report and the overview I'm presenting, I'd be happy to turn over my chair to Bobby Green, our co-chair, for a few more remarks, and then you'll hear it specifically about Senate Bills 78 and 77 and the two recommendations we're bringing you today.
Okay, thank you, but stay close.
Okay, I will. Thanks.
Come on up, Bobby.
Okay.
Welcome.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Chair Burdick and members of the committee, as co-chair of this committee, I'd just like to say that this was an effort that what I would consider to be long overdue. I spent 14 years as a county commissioner and 1 year as the Association of Oregon Counties president. And we have been trying very diligently and consistently to come to the table to work with the state to talk about our partnership at the county. We are your local partners. And I think this was the first comprehensive effort that was undertaken to take a look at. You saw the PowerPoint presentation, and we worked at it for over a year, started in November 2007, and actually through an executive order, and we stayed with it and consistently kept asking the hard questions. And I think as a result of it, the product that you have in front of you will be a good guiding document to help the state and the county go forward. Because it's been my experience that the four-year ramp down of the funds, of the federal funds, it's not a matter of if they go away, it's when they go away. And we've been told that this could be the very last authorization of those payments. So it's very prudent from my perspective that we continue this effort and this journey to go hand in hand down the road so that we can not only continue to deliver, I wouldn't even say a high level of service, I would just say just to sustain the level of services that we are currently providing, because we all share the same constituency at the local level. So it would be important from my point of view as a former commissioner that we continue to work and try to achieve something that's realistic and we can deliver for the for our constituency at the local level. Okay.
Thank you.
Okay. Chair Burdick, members of the committee, I'm Mike MacArthur, the Executive Director of the Association of Oregon Counties. First of all, I want to thank the governor for creating this task force and for sending a deputy chief of staff, Dr. Tim Nesbitt, to lead the task force. You might know, not know it, but Tim received an honorary PhD from our county college in recognition for the his depth of knowledge acquired through this task force work about the nuts and bolts of county government. I also want to thank the many state agencies and their directors that participated throughout, and especially want to thank the state senators and representatives that also participated with us and lent their support. Counties are still in a critical condition. I'd like to say that with the federal payments, we've been partially restored to our previous level of poverty. But we really want to thank the heroic efforts of our congressional delegation, especially Senator Wyden, in giving us this chance, this breathing room, if you will, to try and avoid a catastrophic collapse of services for Oregon citizens. The time's short. Basically, there are less than 2 years' worth of federal payments coming. If you add them together, that 80, 70, 40, it's 190. So we've got less than 2 years of payments coming. By the spring of 2011, you'll again hear counties who are budgeting for that 11-12 biennium considering the severe cutback of services unless we do something. So we need to engage in these planning efforts, and that's what Senate Bill 78 is about. The task force recommendation is that the state take the lead in setting up a mechanism for this planning process. We want to invite the participation of the hard-hit counties and facilitate the planning process through technical assistance and oversight by the council. The task force further recommends that the mechanism for this process be a joint state-county planning council with participation from representatives of the hard-hit counties and our association, representatives of the governor's office, key state agencies, the treasurer, the secretary of state, the chief justice, and representatives of the legislature. Finally, the task force recommends that this process include consultation with all the employee organizations that work with the counties. So Senate Bill 78 sets up the framework for this process, and we hope that you'll support our efforts and move this along by passing Senate Bill 78. Be happy to try and answer any questions.
Thank you. To your knowledge, this doesn't have a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. We can't find one up here. Is that correct?
I really don't know, Madam Chair.
Because I was wondering, this may be a Tim question, whether there would be a fiscal impact of any sort on this. We can figure that out later, but I just thought of somebody. Mm-hmm. That it?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, go ahead.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Amber Hollister, the Governor's Deputy General Counsel. I was tasked with leading a work group as part of the larger task force, County Payments Task Force. It was a fiscal distress work group. The work group was convened for basically the reasons you just heard about, that we sort of saw that cliff coming and wanted to talk about ways to deal with the cliff. It was convened and it's charge was really to consider and evaluate different models for dealing with county fiscal distress and draft recommendations for legislative action. You might know that Oregon, unlike many states, doesn't have any provisions that allow local governments to declare bankruptcy, to engage in municipal bankruptcy. And it also doesn't have any provisions for state supervision or assistance to local governments that are experiencing a financial crisis. Many other states do. So I guess I'll talk first a little bit about the municipal bankruptcy discussion we had within the work group. Under federal law, before a municipality can file for bankruptcy, there actually has to be explicit state legislative authorization for it to do so. We generally do not have that authorization right now in Oregon law. There's a small exception for irrigation districts. The work group discussed municipal bankruptcy, and essentially we agreed that given the near certainty that allowing municipal bankruptcy would raise the borrowing costs for all local governments, it wasn't something we thought that the task force should pursue. So then moving on, we started to talk about different models of fiscal distress legislation. The handout that I provided you today is just sort of a chart here, lays out some of the various approaches that states have taken to fiscal distress legislation. We're all familiar with sort of the anecdotal, the examples of fiscal distress, the Orange County, the New York City, and so different states really have grappled with this problem, and there's been a lot of creative thinking in this area. Generally, fiscal distress legislation does have some commonalities. Usually there is an attempt in the law to establish threshold criteria for declaring municipal financial distress. There's an effort to identify local officials that are empowered to request state assistance in the time of a crisis. There's usually an effort to create a process to develop and approve municipal recovery plans, and some sort of a framework to oversee implementation of the recovery plan, a definition of powers and conditions in the recovery plan, and then some sort of threshold for ceasing state intervention. Usually these fiscal distress legislation models involve an oversight entity that is commonly referred to as a financial control board. You'll see that term a lot. And that would be the entity that would move in to the county or the municipality when there's a fiscal crisis and help that county to recover. We did talk about the different models of fiscal distress legislation. We elected not to pursue an exhaustive package, but we did recognize that there needed to be a measured and thoughtful way to deal with the loss of critical services in counties. Right now, the governor has power under Chapter 401 to declare an emergency when there's, you know, a widespread riot or looting and the like. We discussed that, and the conclusion of the group was that we didn't want to wait until we got to that point. That if a county was having problems and was unable to provide truly critical services, and when I say that, we really focused on public safety, public health, elections, and the like, that we wanted there to be another avenue to at least go into the county and collect information and make sure that the governor's office and the legislature and the county itself was well informed and could sort of take a measured and thoughtful approach to the crisis. So Senate Bill 77 is what came out of that discussion. While we looked at public health, we looked at elections, we came to the conclusion that there was statutory authority, that there was already statutory authority for the state to deal with the public health issue, the elections issue, also there were other mechanisms to deal with that problem, and so that left us with public safety. So the bill you see before you is dealing with, it's our attempt to gauge public safety, a public safety emergency before it really is an emergency. So the work group identified that a failure to maintain public safety at an adequate level could be a likely effect of worsening fiscal conditions. And so that the bill before you creates a process to identify and declare a public safety services emergency in fiscally distressed counties that are unable to provide a minimally adequate level of public safety services. So, again, we're talking about minimums here. The bill outlines a process that would work as follows. First, either the county governing body or the governor's office could request that a declaration be issued. And what that would do is it would trigger an investigation. It would trigger a review by the Criminal Justice Commission. The Criminal Justice Commission would be tasked to go into the county and review whether minimally adequate public safety services exist. In order to help it accomplish that task, we have laid out in the bill a process by which before an emergency is in our laps, the Criminal Justice Commission would establish guidelines for public safety services. And you'll see in the bill there's a list of areas that the commission would consider and would set guidelines for. They would include county jail operations, law enforcement investigation and patrol, community corrections, juvenile justice, emergency operations and response, search and rescue, criminal prosecution, and court facility operation. We recognize that, as Mike reminded us, that when you've seen one county, you've seen one county, so that there is a great need to recognize the differences both in population density and, you know, crime patterns and the like in each county. So in creating these guidelines when the Criminal Justice Commission creates these guidelines, the bill requires that they receive broad public input from not only the county governing body, but we would anticipate from local law enforcement, from unions, from all of the groups that have a stake in this, in the outcome of these guidelines. And again, we really see that there would be a need for flexibility. So that said, I guess we were in the point in the process where the governing body or the governor had asked the Criminal Justice Commission to go into a county. So the Criminal Justice Commission would be in the county. They would use their own guidelines to evaluate whether minimally acceptable public safety services were available. And then they would report back. And they would report back to the governor and provide copies to the other interested parties. And at that point, the governor could look at that objective criteria, could look at the state of the county, and decide to issue a declaration. If the governor issued a public safety services declaration, it wouldn't be the equivalent of a Chapter 401 declaration. What would happen instead is that a financial control board would convene for that county specifically and would go into the county, again, meet with the public, meet with the county governing body, and work to come up with a recovery plan. We would expect that the recovery plan would recommend changes in a lot of areas. Again, these would just be recommendations. The recommendations could include recommendations to reallocate funds, cut services, sell or lease real estate, issue bonds, refer measures to the voters, or authorize the state to take over services as if that's authorized in other law. And so once those recommendations were pulled together, they would be submitted to the county governing body in a recovery plan. And the county governing body would then vote to either accept the plan or to reject it. So we see the financial control board as an additional resource for counties. They would be going in, giving technical advice and support, but they're not in any way be taking away the power of the county, the local control. The Financial Control Board would report to the county itself, would also share its report with the legislature and with the governor's office. Again, putting all of us in a better position to gauge the depth of the problem and to start thinking creatively about how we can fix it. If the county voted to reject the recommendations of the Financial Control Board, the Financial Control Board would be there to continue to monitor the situation, and I would submit that the legislature and the governor's office would be in a much better position to respond, even if the county governing body did reject the plan. So in sum, I think that this is a crucial first step in addressing fiscal crisis in counties. As Tim mentioned, we do see that cliff in the future. This Senate Bill 77 would create a mechanism to ensure that both the legislature and the governor's office are well informed of where our public safety services stand. And with that, that's all I have to say. Thank you.
I don't know whether I'm more discouraged that we need a bill like this or more amazed that we haven't needed it till now. Other questions? Senator Morris.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you to your task force for all the work that you've done. But I have to just share an impression with you. Madam Chair, I think we have the wrong relating clause. The relating clause should read, relating to mortuaries and burial services, because that's the impression that I get. I see a huge disconnect in the recommendation and in the PowerPoint presentation and the findings of the task force, in that if I was to draw one conclusion, is that counties cannot bootstrap themselves up to wholeness. And I don't know whether you would concur. When 18% of the local actions and state actions, you only fill 18% of the gap with what we have control of, and even if the federal government steps in as per our recommendations, the gap is still huge. So where do we go from there? Because if we're providing technical assistance to the collapse of counties, that's not a solution. That's just an assistance to burial. And I'm giving you this reflection not in the sense of disappointment in the work of the task force, because you brought it forward in a way that has never been crystallized before in the past, but I don't see the solution that will provide wholeness for these counties.
Comments on that?
Madam Chair, Vice Chair Morris, I can see where you're coming from, and I think that that's the reason that this task force has 53 recommendations. And I agree with your assessment that this bill is certainly not going to solve the problems. I think that we would all like to prevent counties from reaching that cliff, but we also recognize that we need to plan for the worst case scenario, and that's what this is an attempt to do.
Could we bring Tim Nesbitt back again for a second? Tim, I want to kind of ask about one of your assumptions early in the PowerPoint. It was that some of these counties, and I actually didn't see the data, maybe it's in the other report that we had, but some of the counties have just incredibly low property tax rates that were frozen in place by Measure 50. And your comment was that you could only raise them but so much. And I'm just wondering whether that was a good assumption, since we have other counties out there, including the one I live in, that is just about fully up to the Measure 5 limitation of $15 per thousand of assessed valuation. And yet you have other counties who are, like, I believe there's one that's 60 cents per thousand of assessed valuation. That's a huge difference. And I just wonder what your assumptions were based on and why you didn't kind of take the approach of trying to get all the counties up to some kind of median anyway.
Madam Chair, in our final report, which you'll be receiving for copies of next week, we do have the counties listed from high to low, and as well as alphabetically, so you can look at all the range of property tax rates, which again are frozen into effect by Measure 50. So we begin with great disparity, that's true. The lowest tax counties, like Josephine and Curry, are 59 and 60 cents per thousand. The highest tax counties, like Wheeler and Sherman, are over $8 per thousand, but the statewide average is about $2.80. If you look at counties like Josephine and Curry, they would have to, and I think we would put Douglas in this category too, because I remember running the numbers on Douglas, you'd have to triple or quadruple their current tax rates, and of course that would put them in some cases right at, in some cases a little bit over the statewide average, to recover the lost revenue, to make up for the loss of federal forest payments. The problem with doing that all at once is that it would be very hard to find much precedent for county voters. Maybe there was some in eastern Oregon going back to the 80s and 90s where voters approved tax increases of that magnitude. So we need to be, we thought it was more useful to look at where we have precedent. What was done in Linn County, where actually you're, the way it works, the local option levy for law enforcement is greater than the base operating tax. But we looked at all those counties, and we looked at the ones that just passed last year to get a sense of the size of the steps that local voters are willing to take one step at a time. And it's something in that range of 10, 20, maybe a little as high as 30%. So we felt comfortable as a task force suggesting that as a reasonable next step towards increased local tax effort. We also have to recognize that sudden tax increases of that magnitude can have adverse effects on a local economy. And so we think a phased approach is going to make sense no matter what, not only for political realities, but because of economic consequences as you try and work your way through this. You should view our recommendations as how to get from here to there over the next 4 years, not as the, as a longer-term strategy. Those of you who served in the Revenue Restructuring Task Force have seen projections out to 2020 and beyond, and you know how great the disparity becomes at the local level between the adequacy of funding and the some of those inflationary lines which you've drawn to figure out what the cost of services will be with population growth and inflation in 2020 and beyond. But this is focused really on the next, what we think we can do over the next 4 years. We've gone through, when we first started this effort, we would often hear, and some of our own task force members would say, well, one county is at 60 cents, the average is 280, just bring them all to 280. And that's kind of, that's a understandable first response that we have, but we're looking at numbers on a page here, and when you really kind of think it through and look at what other counties have done and how this is going to work in terms of what voters are prepared to approve, we think it was very helpful to kind of get to a reasonable expectation of next step county tax effort to guide us on and basically flesh out how much we could expect from county taxpayers. And it's almost coincidental that when we added up all these 30-some-odd recommendations for increased state support, we end up solving about, from that source, 18% of the problem. You look at county tax effort in the ranges we've described, 8, 16, 24, they kind of match up. So it's kind of a equity of effort that emerges in our recommendations between county taxpayers and state taxpayers.
And I understand that, but, you know, you take a county like Wheeler County, it's very high on the assessed valuation relative to the value of the property. And what is different about, you know, Curry County or Josephine County that, you know, why shouldn't they be, I can understand the timing disruption, but what is it about that county that would make them any more economically disadvantaged by a reasonable tax rate than a place like Wheeler County?
Madam Chair, if I could make a couple comments. First, going back to Senator Morse's comment, I think, Senator, you're underlining the structural deficiencies of our Oregon revenue system, as you well know from your work with the Revenue Restructuring Task Force. It's broken and getting worse. And so even counties like the chair's are seeing serious fiscal distress. The other comment is that there's great fiscal disparity in terms of density of population and the nature of the population. Curry County, I heard the other day, is over 50% of the people are 60 years or older, many on retired fixed income. Many of these counties that are closest to the edge have tried to go to the voters and get their tax rates raised. As long as the federal government has come through with those measures, people say, well, why should we? The federal government will come through eventually. They have for the last 15, 16 years. One of the reasons that Bobby Green, sitting here as an ex-county commissioner, is his efforts in Lane County to try and adequately provide services by raising various types of revenues, and it wasn't well received by the voters. And maybe he can tell you about that.
you can take the fifth if you want to, Bobby.
Chair Burdick, I think I will, but I will elaborate on one point. I'll give you the Lane County perspective. That's the one I know best. Lane County has a tax rate of $1.27 per thousand. But for the 60 cents that was folded in as a result of the extension services, Lane County would have had a tax rate of about 62 cents, just the difference.
And that's just for the county.
That's just for the county.
Yeah.
And we're serving a population of over 300,000 people. Now, there's reasons why the tax rate is low. It's because we were receiving, as Tim mentioned earlier, we were receiving those timber payments and couldn't quite justify going to the voters asking for a tax rate increase when we were sitting on a reserve. The same with a gas tax. There's no way we can go countywide with a gas tax when we're receiving the road fund revenues as well. So in one shape, we did a good service for the citizens, but as time went on, the population grew, the tax rate was frozen, and we're trying to serve an increase in population with 30-year-old dollars, and it's just very difficult.
And I apologize, I got apples and oranges, because when I was talking about it before, I included the whole schools and the whole Measure 5 thing. So for the county, Tim, right off the top of your head, do you know what Multnomah County is?
On this page, I have $4.34, Senator.
So you have, and of course, that's also affected slightly by the timber. But so you have a great disparity. It's very difficult for, you know, people who live in counties that already subsidize other counties through the school fund and other things to ask them to do a whole lot more for counties who have so much lower a tax rate.
Senator Telford.
Thank you. I have a question regarding the bill itself, and I have not seen the final report and the recommendations, so my concern may be unwarranted. But as I read this bill, it reflects to me that the state has the ability to be the turnaround agent, so to speak, but we're going to wait till a county's in crisis before we jump in and do that. It's kind of like the cemetery, I guess, that Senator Morris was talking about. I'm wondering, though, if the process is better and counties are better served by using some of these turnaround methods that I would expect to be in the recommendations and trying to work with counties now before we get to that position.
Madam Chair, Senator Telfer, that's the purpose of 78. The first bill that I described, Senate Bill 78, would set up the planning councils now to try and get ahead of that work.
Then, because I see 78 as being, you know, the formation of the board, so to speak, the people that are going to do this, 77 saying, well, but we'll step in when there's a crisis.
Madam Chair, Senator Telfer, it's a little different structure in that the Senate Bill 78 puts together a team that cuts across state agencies, governor's office, local folks, unions, and so on, and tries to put together a financial plan ahead of time. I think it's not quite as targeted to public safety. It's broader in scope.
If I might add, Madam Chair, Senator, last June when we delivered our initial report, and then we had public comments and we ended up modifying it, we were asking for state action on a variety of these recommendations in the 2009-11 biennium. Since then, the economy's turned into recession. You have a much bigger problem on your hands in terms of balancing the state budget. So we decided to step back and take a four-year time and put a four-year horizon. But the focus then became, let's work beginning in 2009-11 on the planning component so we can elevate some of these recommendations that make the most sense and be taking actions where there's low cost for the state. We have some of those recommendations, but not really be coming to you for the higher cost financial assistance until the next biennium.
That was wise. Senator Hass.
Thank you. On 78, I was going to ask before Senator Telfer made her remarks that as someone who's been looking at ways to maybe repeal some of the extraneous commissions we have in this state and councils, why we really need this one, if the language is just to encourage effective fiscal planning and to make some recommendations from Ways and Means Committee members about the appropriate level of funding. And if then what you're saying is, well, no, this is the sort of the turnaround council, then either it needs to be beefed up with some action or some authority, mm-hmm. or I just don't see it as a necessity here. I just see it as another council offering encouragement and making some recommendations to the legislature. We have that already.
Madam Chair, Senator Haas, I think that we've tried, as Commissioner Green stated earlier, to engage over the years in the shared services approach to a county state government, and it's not been successful. We need a structure. We need to have it called out in statute. We need to have a way in which we can engage our state partners, and I think this does that in a more formal way.
Other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Any other comments before you go? Okay, thank you. Mr. DeLashment and Mr. Powell are signed up. Here are the
until the
right. You want me to go?
I don't care.
For the record, Brian DeLashment. I'm here representing the Oregon Council of Police Associations, which memberships include county deputy sheriffs and county corrections folks as well. As parole and probation officers. In looking at this bill, I sent it off to the attorneys that represent a number of those organizations, and they had several comments, and I would have some suggestions on the bill. Unfortunately, signing up on the sign-up sheet, it gives you the option of support, oppose, or neutral, and I don't think my comments fit into any of those, although I put oppose as written, and so I would have some suggestions for you. The first concern that they had was in Senate Bill 77, there really is no provision spelled out for inclusion of discussions either at the start of the declaration process by the public safety officers themselves or the unions that represent those public safety officers in determining whether or not they want to, the local county wants to make that formal request for the declaration to be investigated. We have a lot of concern. Obviously, the public safety officers know probably better than anyone whether or not there is a public safety declaration or shortage in an area. And I think inclusion of that is very valuable. The second concern that they had was there really is no definition of physical distress in line 5. Maybe that's a term of art that's used by people all the time, but our attorneys looked at that and said, well, you know, that could mean just about anything. And so we would be concerned about the broadness of that and would hope that maybe a definition could be included in the bill. The third comment that we had was that even though I've heard you've seen one county, our folks indicated that when you have the commission coming in and looking at one county as to whether or not they were providing minimal adequate levels of public safety services in that county, then in fact that would then translate into, well, that's the minimum standard that could be used in any county. And so any county that saw that initial report could turn around and say, well, we've got four too many public safety officers for per capita as compared to that county, and somebody who has some authority has come in and made a declaration that there is in fact a standard that's appropriate for this number of people. So we have a little concern along those lines as well. The recommendations that I would have, and I think at that point we could actually be supporting the bill. We understand the crisis. Our folks at various times over the last few years have received pink slips in anticipation of the federal dollars going away. It creates, a crisis with our membership. I get phone calls, what can you do to help us, not only in the state and nationally. So my suggestions are to include language in the beginning, in Section 1, that includes that public safety officers and the unions that represent them, or public any public safety organizations or unions that are represented, have some interaction in the decision to make the initial declaration. They at least need to be apprised and be a part of that that decision. I would also suggest that you include public safety officers and their unions in the feedback and the investigation of the Criminal Justice Commission. You've heard that they would come and they would seek public input and whatever, but we didn't see it spelled out in this bill, and that's what our attorneys are reacting to. We would like to see language in there that they would come, they'd seek input, including not only the public, but the public safety officers and the unions that represent them. Recognition that nothing in the declaration allows the county to violate any provisions of an existing collective bargaining agreement. And what I'm really talking about there is if the declaration is made, then, in fact, you still have to follow the collective bargaining agreement as far as layoffs or terminations. I don't know that that was the intent. I believe that wasn't the intent. But we like to make sure that if a county is in this kind of a situation and this declaration is made, it is not just an open opportunity for any county government to just basically say, sorry, we don't have to follow any collective bargaining agreement because, in fact, there's been a declaration of emergency made. But you have to still follow the same policy as far as layoffs that were set out in the collective bargaining agreement. And then the last point, which I already touched upon, but assurances that if you've seen one county, you've seen one county, that in fact these standards that would be reviewed and set for any individual county, in fact, wouldn't be the minimal staffing standards for any county in the state. We have fought very long and hard for a number of years for the safety of public safety officers, and as you recall, last session, a lot of discussion about staffing levels as well as it interrelates to safety. We would hate to see this interpreted as this is now the standard for every public safety organization or county in the state. And with that, I believe we could support the bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? John.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, my name is John Powell. Before you, representing Oregon Sheriffs for Action, the 36 county sheriffs of Oregon. Madam Chair and members, I would first, on Senate Bill 77, draw your attention to page 2 and the top of page 3, where it lists the functions of public safety that would be subject to the guidelines. County jail operations, law enforcement investigation patrol, community corrections, juvenile justice, emergency operations, search and rescue and operations, criminal prosecution, and court facility operations. At least four of those are statutory requirements of your sheriff in your county. And we believe that, taken as a whole, this bill is county-specific, and there are a few places where it would simply make sense to have the Office of Sheriff represented from the get-go. The first place is in Section 1 of the bill, when a request for a review of public services has been made by a governing board or the governor. We think when the commission comes in to do that, that the sheriff should be included immediately. They're going to have to be. I mean, the sheriff runs the jail. The sheriff provides, that office provides all of the services that are going to be subject to this review. And the history of those services and things are in that office. And so they're going to have to be, and we would simply suggest that be clear from the very beginning. Also, if you look at the report and findings of the commission, we believe that if the commission makes a report to the governor, we believe that the governing board of the county or the sheriff should also independently be able to report to the governor at that time. Obviously, they could write a letter, but again, we believe they should be able to report to the governor about that report as well. And then finally, the Fiscal Control Board, established in Section 2, has three non-voting ex officio members and five appointed who have knowledge and experience with public safety services. Again, we think there that the sheriff should automatically be a part of that board, and the numbers rearranged on the appointments.
Now, John, did you have an opinion on whether, because the Secretary of State, State Treasurer, and Director of Department of Revenue would be ex officio, you think the sheriff should be an ex officio or a regular member?
Madam Chair, I think a regular member.
Thank you. Okay, go ahead. Are you done?
No, I'm done.
Okay, thank you. Questions from the committee? Okay, thank you very much. I wanted to give Mr. Nesbitt and Mr. O'Leary a chance to comment, if you want to, on some of the suggestions that were made on 77. Don't have to. You can wait, but I thought I'd give you an opportunity.
Madam Chair, in the narrative of our report on the Planning Council, we do call out the importance of involving the unions which represent county employees, and I think the same spirit would carry through to the recommendation on the public safety emergency provisions. As to the consultation and involvement of the employee groups and the sheriffs in each of these instances, I think that's implied and certainly would be consistent with the spirit of the legislation we've developed. As to the makeup of the Financial Control Board, there I think the intent, and I'll let Amber speak a little bit more on this, is to have an outside body, because you already have your elected officials, you have your elected county commissioners, you have your elected sheriff and others in the county who've been engaging this problem. It might bear repeating that we ended up with this recommendation because at the very start of this process. In fact, one of the reasons the governor convened the task force was he had a request from one county, Curry County, to declare a state of emergency, given what they were facing in 2007. And we found no provision in the law to do so, because there wasn't yet the level of crisis that would warrant a declaration under Chapter 401. Yet there was clearly a serious enough problem that could certainly lead to that kind of a crisis. We shouldn't have to wait until we have that level of crisis before the state can respond. So we found ourselves without mechanisms to respond, short of the full-fledged declaration of emergency when conditions are such where the governor might call out the National Guard, and we didn't want to have to wait for that. So we're looking for intermediate actions to forestall even more draconian reactions to even worse situations, which is why we've come up with these as intermediate steps. And I would hope that everybody takes this recommendation in that context. We need a way to respond before the worst happens, we don't have public safety any longer.
I do crisis management planning and implementation in my private business, so I'm very sympathetic to the notion of trying to be prepared for something that we hope will just we would hope we'd never have to use the statute, but to have something on there if the worst happens. Mr. O'Leary, did you have anything to add?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you. For the record, I'm Joe O'Leary, Governor Kulongoski's public safety advisor. It's a pleasure to be here before you this afternoon. I just wish to speak to the issue that was raised about the definition of fiscal distress for purposes of Senate Bill 77 and the requirement in paragraph 9 of the bill that requires the Criminal Justice Commission to establish by rule minimally adequate levels at which public safety services must be delivered. The earlier panel identified the fact that this is not absolutely spelled out exactly what minimally adequate services is, and I want to point out to you that was intentional. The subgroup that came up with this recommendation felt that it would be most appropriate to take an existing commission with expertise in criminal justice matters rather than create a new one that would do that, and assign that commission, which already has rulemaking authority, with the task, which they are in this bill, of seeking input and promulgating rules around what, again, generally, what guidelines speak to minimally adequate public safety services in these listed areas, which are listed in paragraph 9, subs A through H, that constitute really the nuts and bolts of every county's public safety system, only one of which under current law, and that is community corrections, can statutorily, in certain circumstances, be quote-unquote taken over by the state, depending on the funding level that's approved by the legislature for that function. We chose the Criminal Justice Commission, as I said, for several reasons. One, they are the entity that has expertise in-house in criminal justice issues. They're comprised of 7 members and 2 ex officio members of the legislature, 1 House and 1 Senate. And they're currently comprised, their chair is a recently retired circuit court judge from Lane County, Daryl Larson, an elected prosecutor from Clatsop County, a former public defender, a former member of the legislature who currently is employed at Portland State University, and 2 criminal justice researchers, as well as 1 law enforcement member of the commission who is the recently retired police chief of the Gladstone Police Department. This commission has responsibilities to the local public safety coordinating councils in every county. LPSCs, local public safety coordinating councils, which are statutorily created, and their members include all actors in the local public safety community. The members are listed by statute, and they go from the sheriff, county commissioner, city police, district attorney, judges, public defenders, etc. So we thought for a lot of reasons that it really made sense to have the Criminal Justice Commission be the entity that created these guidelines, and then once those again general guidelines were created, would be called into action in the event of the triggering event, a request for a declaration of fiscal emergency, be called into action to actually go into the county on the ground and activate the relationships that they should already have with the local public safety coordinating councils there and other members of the public safety community and the public, and take testimony with a quick turnaround at 14 days and come back and provide a report. Just want to give you that background to explain our rationale for choosing that entity.
Okay, thank you. I might add that that's also the entity that was chosen to designate new drug courts under the meth package. So it's a very versatile agency. I'm a former ex officio member of the Criminal Justice Commission. Thank you. That was just all an excuse to get you back, Joe, because I miss you so much from judiciary. Are there any other questions? Senator Morris.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If I could draw your attention to page 2, line 2 and 3, that references the establishment of a fiscal control board for the distressed county. And my question is the intent to have one fiscal control board for the entire state if you have more than one county in distress, or fiscal control boards for each county? Because the language would suggest each county.
Madam Chair, Senator Morris, you're absolutely correct that we designed this system so that there would be a financial control board for each county, and I think that goes back to the phrase we've been hearing over and over again, that if you've seen one county, you've seen one county, and we recognize that it's going to be most useful to have one team on the ground per county. Of course, we'd like to think that at no time would more than one county need this within the same time frame, but if that were the case, there would be more than one financial control board.
Madam Chair, may I follow up? And Tim, I don't mean to put you on the spot, but you've been closer to this issue than probably anyone as you've led this effort. In your judgment, what's the probability that we will implement this bill and have fiscal control boards to deal with these financial crises in counties?
Senator, it does put me on the spot to kind of handicap the probability. I would say that if we don't take this action, we've already gotten a glimpse of how many counties, Curry County being one of them, would be off the edge, would be at the point where they could, and if I could go back to one of the earlier charts, we identified the crisis counties and the ones that, and I know Curry was one of them, would in effect be contemplating sending the keys back to the state. This ends up being our problem at the state level. And again, having really dug into these budgets and looked at both the immediate impact and the 1, 2, 3, 4 year impacts in these counties, there'll be as many as 9 who, absent action at the county level or absent action at the state level, and absent reauthorization of the federal forest payments, which nobody now thinks likely. Whenever you see a ramp down like that, it pretty much means that's where you end up. That's the intent of it. That we will have as many as 9 counties unable to maintain basic services, including public safety, and that we would have a worst-case scenario. So with the Planning Council in place, and to answer the earlier question from Senator Haas, this is also a mechanism for accountability and responsibility from the affected counties. They'd be coming forward. They'd be meeting with representatives of state agencies and legislators, and they'd know that they'd be knowing they'd have to be making equal efforts at the county level to match the efforts being requested at the state level. So there's a mutual accountability there, a motivation for that. We think we need that, because if this too many things can be let, we can let them slide. And let's face it, you're going to be thinking most of your days this session about your own budget at the state level. And so absent this kind of a mechanism put in place that we can deal with over the next couple of years, it slides, we're at the edge of the cliff, and we're back in 2011 saying these many counties can't be counties anymore.
Thank you. There's a follow-up comment. It's a high probability that we'll be exercising this legislation. And the search for systemic solutions to systemic problems should begin now. And you know, I can get on my soapbox, but I won't, about those systemic solutions. But you know, this provides a Band-Aid to a very deep infection, and it doesn't offer really systemic solutions. This is necessary, and I concur with this legislation, but it doesn't address the underlying shortfalls that somebody has to tackle at some point in time.
If I may, Madam Chair, and Senator Morris, agree completely, and I think that's the revelation from the work of the Revenue Restructuring Task Force. I think you mapped a way to get the stability on the state side. And what I came away from, having watched your work over the last year, is that the next big problem we have to tackle is this one: the funding level. The funding levels at the local level, counties in particular. It's not sustainable.
My general impression is that we really do need to do something like Senate Bill 77. And as far as Senate Bill 78 goes, I'm not seeing the how much difference that would make. Can you help me out there?
Well, Madam Chair, that was the point I was trying to make, that we can always get together and talk about what should be done. Mm-hmm. We've identified recommendations for how the state can help and how counties can help themselves. If we don't create a more serious mechanism and a venue where there's the import of this kind of legislation, where the legislature votes to be involved, the governor commits to be involved, and counties know if they're not involved, they're not holding up their end of the effort. We're looking for that. And I really think that we ended up with members of the Ways and Means Committee attending some of our task force meetings. That helped an awful lot. And we would hope to have that kind of involvement from the Legislative Assembly. We really need to give this the importance it deserves and create a venue. A county that would choose not to participate would be saying we can handle it ourselves and would not be listened to in 2011 saying, you know what, we need a lot of money because otherwise we can't do what we're supposed to do as a county. So it's that which we're trying to create here.
Okay, well, we'll continue the discussion. Is there any other, are there any other questions from the committee?
Thank you very much.
Thank you
for
coming back. Anybody else in the audience who wants to say anything about these two bills? Okay, we will close the, any other comments, Paul?
Reminder about tomorrow.
Oh, yes. Tomorrow we have our, gosh, it's Thursday already. We have our very special meeting that is so popular with my committee at 2 o'clock tomorrow afternoon, and I thank my committee very much for agreeing to show up for that. We are adjourned.